prior to September 11th of last year, one question that came up repeatedly among Holocaust revisionists was, why don't Arabs understand how Holocaust claims are being used to further Jewish agendas at their expense? Part of the answer to this question is that there's a huge gap between what the Arab world knows and understands and what the Western world knows and understands. It is rare to find someone who can bridge this gulf. That's why we are so pleased to introduce our next speaker, Syed Arakat. Mr. Arakat was born in Palestine but has lived for most of his life in the United States. Mr. Arakat holds degrees from the California State University Long Beach and the University of San Francisco. After leaving school, he worked as an engineer in California before moving to the East Coast. He now lives with his family in suburban Washington, D.C. He is a correspondent and political analyst for Al Quds, the leading Palestinian daily paper, and in recent years has appeared many times on American news and public affairs television programs as a Palestinian analyst and commentator. You've probably seen him, in fact. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Syed Arakat.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the honorary degree because I'm not a doctor, but thank you anyway. So, you know, I wish I could follow in the footsteps of Tony Martin and Bradley Smith. They were witty and prolific, and I don't really have that talent. So you have to bear with me while I read to you my presentation. But I want to say something before I start to Tony Martin. I don't know where he's been, but there is a tremendous outrage in the American Jewish community about the U.S. media being so excessively pro-Palestinian. So there is a lot of demonstrations going on at the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Times, the New York Times. I mean, the Washington Post and the Washington Times, forget it. It's a different newspaper altogether, but the Post. And, in fact, many of the programs. Obviously, I want to talk to you about the one thing that really concerns me most and concerns us as Palestinians and Arabs most, and what is going on in America and how that affects us. So it is really at once very easy and very difficult to speak about the Palestine in particular and the Arab-Israeli conflict in general. On the one hand, it is a simple proposition. For those involved in the conflict and their supporters, it is quite easy to adopt contentious, argumentative, and moralistic stances that are not readily pliable for compromise, with real passions, however misguided these passions may be on both sides. On the other hand, more than any other conflict, this one is replete with contradictions and competing strives and struggles. For one thing, it has been and continues to be so conspicuous in the news. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that you don't read something about the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It is always prominent. It is always conspicuous. It has many tentacles, such as the involvement of the major powers, and has been for over 70 years, to the present of divine preeminence, if you allow me, the hand of God, so to speak. It is always present in the conflict. You know, I, for one, if I were to review history, I think there's been a lot of problems due to religious involvement and so on and the struggles that we have experienced as human beings. So the Middle East is a region with a long and tumultuous history of bloody and repeated invasions, shifting alliances, and changing powers, so much so that a great deal can get lost in the fog of this historical confusion. There is a great deal of confusion. To us, it's very simple, but to the general public, the American public, the world community, there is a great deal of confusion. It is also a region that at once stands at the crossroads between Europe and the West, on the one hand, and the Orient and its exotic cultures and resources on the other. In short, this region holds two strategic significances for the West. One, it is historically and infinitely, it straddles a vital geographical axis. And two, it sits upon the largest oil reserve in the world. And we in the West, you know, that is really our way of life. When we say the American way of life, it is a great deal of it is dependent on access to cheap oil. We have an insatiable desire for oil, and we will oppose any foe, defend any friend, go to any length, depth, or width to make sure that your freeways in Southern California remain clogged with toxin-emitting SUVs, you know. So, if you have any doubt about the nature of what's going on, just look at Mr. Bush's cabinet, you know. So that tells the story right there. It is also a region that has been born in the womb of one dying empire, two ailing ones, and two ascending ones, with diametrically opposed ideologies that were unlike anything similar in the past, America and the Soviet Union, and that were about to embark on a conflict that would in turn inaugurate new rules to the game of hegemony. In reality, and you know, I don't know, maybe you've heard this before, maybe you haven't, but I'm going to say it anyway. In reality, all the countries in the region, and not only the state of Israel, are chronically ailed with the legitimacy and disfigured geography. You know, some may think that disfigured geography is too strong a term, but in fact, that's what it was. All these factors have fundamentally converged together, creating the confusion and ironic conflicting modalities that are so intertwined, ultimately producing the mosaic we have come to call the Middle East. It created in Israel a militaristic monster, premised on the supremacy of one group of people above all others, an Israel that has practiced ever since it was founded some of the most despicable and heinous criminal acts against humanity, against a population virtually unarmed, whether through its brutal military occupation or the destruction of homes and the ethnic cleansing, the uprooting of trees, the plowing over of agricultural fields and lives, an Israel that still employs till this very day blatant racial discrimination practices, as part and partial and a necessary part and partial for its continued colonial project. So an Israel that cynically continues to flaunt its total disregard for international norms and legalities in the name of international norms and legalities. Let's remember that Israel was created by the United Nations. But beyond that, almost every UN resolution concerning its existence, its occupation of the Palestinians, you can go on and on and on. You know, its adventures in Lebanon, its occupation of Lebanon, have been discarded into the wastebasket. And why? Because it has monopolized the unquestioning support of a United States that is far too arrogant and far too self-absorbed to rein in its power and its prestige or guard against their misuse in the service of ill will, because it has acquisitioned the support of a U.S. Congress that has forfeited the most basic elements of decency for the shallow benefit of special interests. You know, and take this from me for what it's worth. I think the Holocaust is a horrible event in human history, and it's a terrible event. And what is even more terrible about the Holocaust, that it can happen. And it has happened many times since 1945 on different scales. I mean, we have a Holocaust museum in Washington, and that's fine. People ought to be reminded that this thing can happen. But what we ought to have is that museum being in Berlin. What we ought to have in Washington is a museum for the Holocaust of slaves in America, for the Holocaust of the Native Americans in America. That's what we ought to have in Washington, D.C. So it is appropriate at this juncture to speak a little about the much talked about pro-Israeli lobby. To begin with, I'd like to set the record straight. I don't really subscribe to the notion that there is a grand Zionist conspiracy to overtake America. I believe that two things are happening and happen. First, America today is governed and run by the elite. And the Jewish community, the Jewish Americans, by wits or by the need to survive in a potentially hostile environment, have done all the right things to garner a disproportionate segment of this elite. Second, whether we like it or not, there is a real and organic reciprocity as seen by the elite that runs America, that its interest and cultural and religious affiliation puts it naturally on the side of Israel. Having said this, it behooves us to note that until recently, America's Middle East policy was a peripheral part of the global strategy, which focused on preventing the Soviet Union from intimidating U.S. allies in Western Europe and East Asia. Britain was the dominant Western power in the Middle East until 1960. And U.S. influence was countered in much of the region by the Soviet Union until the end of the Cold War. The indifference of much of the national security elite and the public to the region in between crises permitted U.S. policy to be dominated by two U.S. domestic lobbies, one ethnic and one economic, the pro-Israeli lobby and the oil industry, which occasionally clashed, you know, like when it came to, let's say, selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. These two lobbies have clashed. Times have changed. The collapse of the Soviet Union created a power vacuum, which has been filled by the U.S. first in the Persian Gulf following the Gulf War, and now in Central Asia as a result of the Afghan War. Today, the Middle East is becoming the center of U.S. foreign policy, a fact illustrated in a most shocking way by the Al-Qaeda attack on New York and Washington. A debate within the U.S. over the goals and methods of American policy in the Middle East is long overdue. Unfortunately, an uninhibited debate is not taking place because of the disproportionate influence of the pro-Israeli lobby. Today, the pro-Israeli lobby distorts U.S. foreign policy in a number of ways. Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, enabled by U.S. weapons and money, inflames anti-American attitudes in the Arab and Muslim countries. The expansion of Israeli settlements on Palestinian land makes a mockery of the U.S. commitment to self-determination for places like Kosovo or East Timor or Tibet. The U.S. strategy for dual containment of Iraq and Iran pleases Israel, which is most threatened by them, allegedly, you know, but violates the logic of realpolitik and alienates most of America's other allies beyond the region. U.S. policy on nuclear weapons proliferation is undermined by double standard that has led to ignore Israel's nuclear programs while condemning those of India and Pakistan and so on. The debate that is missing in the U.S. is not one between Americans who want Israel to survive and those, you know, which are really, in this country, are a marginal minority, who want Israel to be destroyed. The U.S. supports Israel's right to exist and has done so ever since the state was created. But it has done so within internationally recognized borders and Israel's right to defend itself against threats to these borders. What is needed is a debate between those who want to link U.S. support for Israel to Israeli behavior in light of the Americans' own strategic goals and moral ideas, and those who want there to be no linkage. For the American pro-Israeli lobby, listen to what Tony Smith observes in his authoritative study, Foreign Attachment, The Power of Ethnic Groups in the Making of American Foreign Policy, published by Harvard. Quote, to be a friend of Israel or pro-Israel apparently means something quite simple, that Israel alone should decide the terms of its relation with its Arab neighbors and that the U.S. should endorse these terms, whatever they may be. The pro-Israeli lobby is one special interest pressure group among many. It is a loose network of individuals and organizations, of which the most important are, of course, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, described by the Detroit Jewish News as a veritable training camp for Capitol Hill staffers, and the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. The pro-Israeli lobby is not identical with a diverse Jewish-American community. Many Jewish Americans are troubled by Israeli policies and some actively campaign against them, while some non-Jewish Americans, most of them members of the Protestant right, play a significant role in advocating a very fanatical pro-Israeli stance. Look, to talk about the pro-Israeli lobby and gives it its due really takes a great deal of time. In a nutshell, there is something wrong when someone like Benjamin Netanyahu gets invited to the Senate, to a special session of Congress, and lecture America on how it ought to deal with the Arab world, lecture America how it ought to deal with the problems that are going on today. There is something wrong. There is something wrong when the President of the United States goes out and calls Sharon, a man who is a war criminal by all accounts, even, you know, indicted in his own country, comes out and calls him a man of peace. I bet you Sharon himself was offended, you know. So, you know. So there's something wrong when the other day Sharon meets with the Foreign Relations Committee, and you know, Biden comes out, Joseph Biden, a great liberal, comes out and he says we support Israel, period, right or wrong. No, that is not what America is all about. America is all about, you know, right. It's all about advocating liberties. America is all about having constitution. Yeah, the President of the United States came out several weeks back, and he said, you know, the Palestinians must have a constitution. And I agree. I think the Palestinians must have a constitution. But Israel also must have a constitution. Israel does not have a constitution. You know? So, you know, I may not go as far as Pat Buchanan said when he said that, you know, Capitol Hill is an Israeli-occupied territory, and called it, you know. But you know, I will not venture that far, and he called it Israel's Ammon Corner. But there is also something wrong that we as Americans must really stand up to. Dick Armey came out on national television, the majority leader, and came out and advocated ethnic cleansing for the Palestinians. He said, take them out of the West Bank, take them out of Gaza, and throw them out. So I think this is despicable. This is something that we ought to stand against. You know, and I will not attempt. I mean, I live in Washington. I see all the think tanks. I will not even attempt to venture into the stranglehold that very fanatical pro-Israeli groups have gotten over these institutions, be it the Brookings or be it the Near East Institute, which is another, you know, another AIPAC front and so on. So we'll leave that alone, because I want to talk to you about something else. You know, I want to go back to how the Middle East was born in this womb. I said that it's not only Israel that it really suffers from this illegitimate geography, but also the Arab countries. You know, this new colonialism, it created in Israel a militaristic monster, but also created in Syria and in Iraq, for instance, created conditions that are equally monstrous. Equally monstrous dictatorships to emerge that continue until this very day, rule through the sheer fear and brutality, disallowing their people the most basic human rights or democratic freedoms. This, of course, don't misunderstand me. This, of course, should not be misinterpreted in any way as advocating the continuing aggression that the United States conducts against Iraq today. It is not in any way to be misinterpreted as advocating the continuation of the sanctions that only kill Iraqis and does not hurt the regime. These sanctions must end now, immediately. They must end. It created in Jordan a fiefdom held together by tribal intrigue and nepotism for the sole purpose of absorbing the consequences of the creation of the State of Israel and the destitution and decimation of Palestinian society. In Saudi Arabia, it created one of the most reactionary regimes in modern history, where the whole country and its citizens are not only named for the royal family, but indeed treated as they were owned by it, where women are not only treated as second-class citizens, but in fact are treated as something less than human, where the ruling family cowardly hides behind a reactionary interpretation of Quranic teachings, perpetuating religious intolerance and dogmatic ignorance in order that the royal family may continue with its own excesses, corruption, pilfering the country's resources. The same is true of all the other fiefdoms and sheikdoms and so on, the oil countries in the Persian Gulf. In Egypt, you know, our great ally, Hosni Mubarak, in Egypt, an autocratic regime whose honor and national dignity were cheaply bought off at the expense of tens of millions of its impoverished people. I will not even venture to go into what's going on in North Africa, because that's, you know, another subject and so on. And lest we despair, I will have plenty to say about Arafat's shameful ruling tradition. I mean, I'm a Palestinian, and I'm really in direct touch of what's going on and what has happened to the Palestinians under Arafat's leadership. Why so badly did the Palestinians from one disaster to another? Yasser Arafat comes and fits cogently into the larger Arab political tradition. Ever since he assumed leadership of the Palestinians, Arafat has been Arafat. He maintained his power through manipulation, favoritism, corruption, and the elimination of his opponents and circumventing of any sincere Palestinian revolutionary effort. Without rehashing his history at the helm of the Palestinian liberation movement, one can see the obvious. Swinging between the interests of the Arab regimes and the Palestinian aspiration, Arafat managed again to lead the Palestinians from one disaster to another. Always duplicitous, always trying to turn the energy of and the sacrifice of the Palestinians into some sort of a capital for self-promotion and sustenance. As the Palestinian movement was being dislocated from place to place, Arafat remained the common denominator among the Arab regimes and tacitly approved of by the international community as the one person capable of delivering. So in the aftermath of the Gulf War and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Arafat felt that the time was ripe for capitulating. Unbeknownst to the rest of the PLO leadership or the rank and file of the Palestinians, Arafat entered through a couple of his cronies into secret negotiations with the Israelis to work out, to orchestrate, to produce this capitulation. And thus, the much talked about Oslo Accords were born. The accords that were signed with much fanfare on the front lawn of the White House on the morning of September 13, 1993, were meant to provide Israel with legitimacy of occupation and provide this occupation with security by none other than the Palestinian people. Let me explain. Oslo is all about security of Israel, i.e. legitimizing the occupation and have the Palestinians be obligated to providing the security for this obligation. It really boggles the mind. Here in front of the whole world, witnessed by many a world leader, what you had is the victim signed on as a guarantor of his tormentors' abuse and oppression. That's what happened to the Palestinians with Oslo. Then, you know, then the litany of negotiations and agreements to renegotiate the negotiations, previously agreed upon agreements, Oslo 1, Oslo 2, Cairo 1, Cairo 2, Taba, names that may not make any sense to you. But there were always, you know, the Y River, you come back and you renegotiate and you implement and so on. So Oslo became an albatross around the neck of the Palestinians. Between 94 and 2000, you know, while the world was too busy watching this insane, you know, ascendancy of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and everybody was being connected to the information superhighway and so on. What was happening to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, that they were doubly jeopardized and doubly oppressed. On the one hand, you have the Israeli occupation, the settlements, the land grabs, and on the other, Yasser Arafat's corrupt, inept authority with something like 13 or 14 security forces trained, equipped, and financed by the CIA to quash the last vestiges of Palestinian resistance to occupation. I'm sure I'm getting in trouble with my newspaper. Okay, the closures became more frequent, the chokehold more suffocating, the curfews longer and longer, the standard of living plummeting, appetite more visible, settlements encroaching alarmingly, and the occupation is becoming more legitimate. All the while, Arafat was playing president with all the pomp and ceremony. Then the game was up. Upon arriving at Camp David in the summer of 2000, there was no more juice to squeeze out of Yasser Arafat. He had been sucked dry by the Clinton administration and its peace negotiators, who, by the way, they were either all former AIPACers or AIPACers now. You know, so the entire team. So he could not deliver, and the charade was over. The so-called peace dividend promised to the Palestinians as a result of Oslo was never there, and no one knew this better than the Palestinians themselves. On September 28, 2000, all hell broke loose as it should. You know, the Palestinians freed themselves from the shackles of Oslo and began to go about the business of national liberation, as they should. And that is exactly what you have today. So once you sort through the fog of the propaganda and disinformation, you will find quite simply that what is going on today is the Palestinians conducting their campaign for national liberation and the Israelis waging a war by all means to deprive them of that goal. It is the classical anti-colonial struggle, albeit so late, because the Zionist colonization of Palestine is really a Johnny-come-lately in the game of colonization. You know? So, and would not have been able to survive, or the chance to survive, had it not been for the sheer power and blindness of the United States and its predecessor of imperialists. Like the Algerians in Algeria and the South African in South Africa, the Palestinians are struggling to rid themselves of colonialism and achieve independence. It's very simple. And like the Algerians and South Africans, the Palestinians, I believe, will win the day, and they will win their independence. So how can one begin to talk about the current turmoil? What should the Palestinians think? What should they think when they read, as reported by the Israeli largest newspaper, Yedot Ahronot, that Israeli school children, you know, they always talk about how the Palestinians talk about, fomenting violence and writing in their textbook about, denying Israel's right to exist and denying the Jews their right to exist and so on. But the fact of the matter, it is the other way around. If you read Israeli textbook deny that even the Arabs have existed there. They deny thousands of years of history. They deny that, and they tell you that there were tribes, that these were savages, that the country was a desert, and that we came and we made the desert bloom. So what do the Palestinians do when they hear this? They hear it day after day. They see the racism. They see the brutality of the checkpoints. They see their parents, their grandparents, their children disallowed from going to school, their parents disallowed from going to work. You can't go from one place to another. I come from a small village on the outskirts of Jerusalem, and right across the street there is another village. It will take someone today 3-4 hours and maybe 4 or 5 modes of transportation, including donkeys and mules and so on, to get from one point to another that are really no more than 1 mile or 2 miles apart. So this is what is happening. Or when they write, the school children, that is Israeli school children, they write to the soldiers, and I quote, that's from Edot Arnold, "I pray for you that you return home safely and kill at least 10 of them. 10 for me. Let the Palestinians, may God blacken their name, burn in hell. Punch holes in them with your M16 and bomb the hell out of them." That's what they write to them. What should the Palestinians think when New York Times reporter Chris Hedges writes in Harper's Magazine that he has watched Israeli soldiers day after day taunt Palestinian children and then shoot them for sport? And yet no one else in the media is interested enough to investigate. That is the very pro-Palestinian media, by the way. Let alone express outrage and indignation over their criminal practices. What should the Palestinians think when House Majority, I told you that, when House Majority Leader think that it is okay to conduct ethnic cleansing among them? Or again, as when Bush says, Sharon is a man of peace. Sharon, who is responsible not only for the Sabra and Shatila massacres, but massacres before that, in 56 and 55 and 54, this is a very, very bloody man as far as the Palestinians are concerned. What should the Palestinians think when they hear tens of thousands of Jewish Americans loudly boo and hiss the very pro-Israeli lobby itself because he said that there are innocent Palestinians? On April 15, there was a huge rally in Washington, D.C. It was really a hate rally. It was organized by the pro-Israeli elements, the American Jewish Committee, all AIPAC, all of them. And Paul Wolfowitz, our Deputy Secretary of Defense, who is an extreme pro-Israeli advocate and person, came out and he says there are innocent victims among the Palestinians. And he was booed. And he was booed not only by those who were present, but by all members of Congress that were sitting there standing with him. I think that was really a shameful day for America. A continuing occupation and a continuing humiliation creates desperation. What should they do? Some turn themselves into human bombs. Straight and simple. if they are left with their own bodies as the only means in which to exact pain on their oppressors, they will do that. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm no advocate of that. But that's really what happens. They're left with nothing. They're desperate. There's not a single family that has not suffered from having a son imprisoned, a son killed, a home destroyed, a field plowed, you know, on and on and on and on and on. The oppression of the Palestinian is a 24-hour event. It goes on endlessly. Lastly, I want to dispel some myths that have really become the hallmark of what you hear on the evening news and what you read in the morning newspapers nowadays. One, you know, they talk about the moral equivalency, you know, that Israel, it's okay for Israel to kill the Palestinians, but what the Palestinians do is horrible, morally horrible. You know, time and again you hear the pundits pontificate, there is no moral equivalence between suicide bombing on the one hand and Israel's killing of Palestinians on the other, because while suicide bombing deliberately targets civilians, Israeli forces do not. Well, you know, it's some of course consider suicide bombing to be a reprehensible act and unacceptable. In fact, many Palestinians feel that way. And, you know, believe me, the Palestinians love their children. They don't send them out to die. We love our families, we love our children, but we also love our land, and we see that it's evaporated, it's been taken away by this group of settlers that have come to destroy, kill, and brutalize them. What is almost missing always, you know, in the American media is a similar condemnation of Israeli deliberate targeting of Palestinian civilians. Just look at the statistics. Since the current Palestinian uprising started in late September 2000, more than 1,700 Palestinians, the vast of whom are civilians, and in fact kids under the 14 years of age, you know, and of course the number of wounded and injured and so on is tremendous. It's many times that number. Israel and its apologists claim that while Palestinian suicide bombers, you know, target Israeli civilians, Israel tries avoiding harming Palestinian civilians, and that those who have died are collateral damage. This defies both, you know, common sense and all the available evidence. All the human rights groups have talked about how the Israeli army really targets Palestinian children and Palestinian families. Yesterday, there was a group of family sitting collecting fruits in their field, and they were decimated by a tank shell. Because maybe an Israeli soldier felt a need for revenge or was bored or for whatever reason. But there you have it, three kids, their mother and the father picking fruits to eat, you know, and they were decimated. So that, you know, falls flat on its face. And you know, let me tell you something. Everybody talks about the suicide bombing, and it's an ugly thing. I'm not someone who thinks it's a great thing, but they want to end the suicide bombing. Give the Palestinians F-15. Give them F-16s. Give them Apache helicopters. Give them the weapons that we pay for as American taxpayers. And let us have a fair fight. Let us have a fair fight. Or just end that horrible occupation and get the hell out of there. That's the way to end the suicide bombing, you know. They tell you that Israel's invasion, they talk about self-defense. They tell you that Israel's invasion of Palestinian cities and refugee camps is self-defense against suicide bombing. The Israeli claim that it attacks on Palestinian, on the Palestinians constitutes self-defense, ignores the fact that its presence in East Jerusalem, the West Bank and Gaza Strip is by definition not defensive. You know, it was acquisitioned by war. Since 1967, Israel has maintained tens of thousands of heavily armed troops outside its borders for the purpose of stealing land from the Palestinians and forcing them to live as a non-citizen group under foreign military dictatorship. Seized Palestinian land has been used to build Jewish-only settlements linked by a network of Jewish-only roads in flagrant violation of UN Security Council resolutions and the 4 Geneva Convention. This colonization is and can only be carried out by the violent suppression of any and all Palestinian resistance to the occupation. Throughout the years of the peace process, during the peace process during the 1990s, Israel continued to construct settlements, doubling the number of settlers in the West Bank from about 100,000 to 200,000, according to the Israeli group Peace Now, which is an Israeli group. At least 34 new settlements have been built since Sharon took office a year ago, a year and 4 months ago. The settlement colonization policy is and can only be carried out by the violent suppression of any and all Palestinian resistance to the occupation. Throughout the years of the peace process, Israel continued to construct settlements, doubling the number of settlers and bringing about more misery and more dislocation and more disenfranchisement of the population, the Palestinian population. The international community by its entirety has recognized that Israel's military occupation must end, and that its continuation along with the settlement policy and the massive repression they entail is a guarantee to continued bloodshed. Israel's brutal actions in the occupied territories are designed to consolidate and entrench the occupation and expand Israeli colonization, and are therefore by definition not defensive in nature. The third thing, they say that this intifada is Arafat's intifada, that after he failed to get what he wanted at Camp David, Arafat went and ignited the intifada. Come on, that is really a true insult to the Palestinians. Because the intifada, in my opinion, is as much against Arafat's corruption, who was servicing the colonial project in Palestine, as it was against the Israeli occupation. So that also falls flat on its face. The intifada was a reaction to many, many years of worsening conditions in the occupied territories. During the period of the so-called peace process, when Israel again doubled its settlers and tightened the noose around the Palestinian population. But the spark was Ariel Sharon's visit to Al-Haram Sharif with 1,000 armed men on September 28, 2000, a deliberate desecration of a holy site whose purpose was to send a message that Israel would always control Palestinians by brutal force. And, you know, once again, you have to look at it from the Palestinian point of view. And I'm not talking about, you know, 1948 or the 54 years that have gone by and the creation of Israel. I'm talking about the Palestinians and 22% of their land. They have had to endure a very brutal military occupation for the past 35 years. For the past 35 years, their life has been interrupted. It is the last military occupation on earth today. They are disallowed to go to school. Kids are disallowed to go to schools. Parents are disallowed to work. They are disallowed to visit one another. They are disallowed to go from point A to point B. So that can be a very brutal thing. Ultimately, people revolt because people want to go out and gain their freedom. The Palestinians, like it or not, the Palestinians that blow themselves up are echoing Patrick Henry and saying, give me liberty or give me death. And then, you know, there's the fourth point is Israel's generosity. Wherever you turn, you hear them saying that Arafat spurned Barak's generous offer at Camp David and broke off negotiations with Israel. It is, of course, a powerful myth, and it is propagated by the U.S. media over and over again. One of the things that I have done is I interviewed for my newspaper Dennis Ross, the chief American negotiator. And I went to him and I asked him, point blank, was there an offer made by Barak? And he said there was never an offer made by Barak. What happened? These fellows, you know, Dennis Ross, Aaron Miller, Martin Indyk, all of them are former AIPACers. All of them, they would take the Israeli point of view and they would try to shove it down the Palestinian negotiators. But, you know, there was nothing more to give. They had taken everything. The settlements had gone on. Netanyahu had been there for 3 years where he stole and so on. So the Israelis look at the Palestinians in the occupied territory as cogs in their wheel, as means to perpetuate and propagate and help that colonial process and their own decimation to continue. If they don't, then they are all terrorists. So the myth was given life in large, of course, by President Clinton, who, you know, they forced Arafat to come to Camp David, by the way. Arafat did not want to come to Camp David, but they forced him. Arafat, you know, to his credit, says, look, you know, the times are, and the conditions are not ripe to arrive at a peaceful settlement that can tackle all the major and, you know, complicated issues such as the return of the refugees and such as the Jerusalem issue and so on. But they forced him to come to Camp David. And he was promised. He was promised by Clinton that if the summit fails, because Arafat warned Clinton that the summit was going to fail. But he promised him, if the summit fails, there will be no pointing, no finger pointing. But immediately upon the summit failing, he went out and he said the blame falls on Arafat. So that is really, that's why this myth was created. Now the negotiations, of course, continued on, you know, right after the Intifada and well into the end of January 2001. But then Barak saw that it was far more beneficial for him to go back and run for election against Sharon, and they put everything on hold. So let me tell you about the proposal. The proposal that they had proposed to the Palestinians. It had no territorial contiguity for a Palestinian state, no control of external borders, limited control of its own water resources, very limited as a matter of fact, and no full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territory as required by international law. In addition, the Barak plan would have included continued Israeli military control over large segments of the West Bank, including almost all of the Jordan Valley. Second, codified the right of Israeli forces to be deployed in the Palestinian state at a very short notice. It would have meant the continued presence of fortified Israeli settlements and Jewish-only roads in the heart of the Palestinian state, and it would have required nearly 4 million Palestinian refugees to relinquish their fundamental human rights in exchange for compensation to be paid, not by Israel, but by the international community. And of course, it would exonerate and would absolve Israel from its responsibility for the refugee problem. Another myth is that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. We always hear that, you know. Israel is the greatest democracy in the Middle East. You know, I don't know where one can begin with this one. But I am certain that Israel provides its Jewish citizens with democratic freedoms and equality. And now, granted that some Jews are more equal than others in Israel, but it's only Jewish-only democracy. What about the million and so Palestinian Arabs that have Israeli citizenship? You know, by the same token, South Africa gave democratic freedoms to the whites in South Africa. Did that make it a democracy? And where's the Constitution? Where is the Constitution in Israel? I will tell you very modestly, and I'm a modest man, I'm no great intellectual or scholar, I think there is a real problem with coming up with an Israeli Constitution. Because Constitutions, as ours says, as our American Constitution, which is a great example for anyone to follow a path to democracy, begins and is premised on the fact that all men are created equal. I think they have a real problem, the Israelis, because how can you reconcile being chosen on the one hand and being all men are created equal on the other? That is a real problem. And finally, you know, ever since the horrors of September 11, we have heard time and again that America's war is Israel's war. Israel's war against the Palestinians is America's war. You know, that Arafat is Osama bin Laden. I will tell you, I think Sharon is Osama bin Laden. You know, it's not Arafat and the Israeli leadership. The fact of the matter that we in America were not occupying Afghanistan. The fact of the matter that we in America do not brutalize the Afghani people. The fact of the matter that America, for better or for worse, for good or for ill, you know, I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent, have put forth, you know, men, material, and effort to liberate Afghanistan back in the 1980s. On the other hand, Israel continues to occupy by sheer military force a population of 3.5 million people, disallowing them the freedom to move, the freedom to create a state, the freedom to have independence. So the war that is Sharon is waging on the Palestinians is an entirely different war from the war that is being waged by the United States in Afghanistan to fight terror. And that is not really, and I don't want you to misunderstand me again, I'm not advocating that war. I think there are many other ways in which we can curtail the terror and we can rein in the scourge of terrorism. Let us look
at the source of this terrorism. Let us look, let America, this great country, the sole remaining power in the world, single power in the world, let it look at the source of these problems. And I believe that with our resources and our commitment to decent values, to democracy, to freedom, we can find a great deal of answers. But I tell you, our appetite for cheap oil is what kept the Saudis as they are. Our appetite for cheap oil is what kept the Emirates as they are. I remember Jim Baker in 1990 when he came out and they asked him about Kuwait. Why are we going to Kuwait? Why are we putting 600,000 soldiers and sending them to Kuwait? You know what he said? He didn't say that we're out there to liberate Kuwait. You know, after all, Kuwait was run by a middle-aged monarchy where the Sheikh of Kuwait was having a new bride every other day, you know. So we didn't go there for freedom and democracy. He went there, he said, he called it jobs, jobs, jobs. But it is really cheap oil. And cheap oil. And today, in our grand designs, we have to question. We have to cast doubt. I think it is very patriotic for Americans today to say, look, wait a minute, let us question what the Defense Department is doing. Let us question what the Pentagon is doing. Is this a fair war? Is it a fair war that we go into Central Asia and do this thing? Is it a fair war that we can say that the world can only be divided into either with us or against us? No. I don't think it is fair. I don't think we ought to call these people evildoers. I don't think we ought to say, you know, if you're not with us, you are completely against us. I think that it behooves all of us to go in and look at the sources. And in the meantime, I can assure you that the Palestinian people have a tremendous capacity for struggle. They have struggled for a very, very long time. And they will continue this struggle until they achieve revelation and liberation. And I thank you. I think there are many understand that dichotomy. I mean, but I will tell you, we, the Palestinians, see themselves as victims of the Holocaust. I mean, after all, as a result of the Holocaust, and I don't want to delve into, you know, the numbers and so on and all these things, but again, you know, Israel was created under that pretext, so in many ways the Palestinians are a victim of that reality.
I want to second that, because I think what should be brought into the discussion is the Talmud, which is the book of hate, which is thousands of years old and needs to be hammered over and over and over again.
Well, you know, I'm not a religious scholar. I don't know much about the Talmud. I don't even know much about the Quran, so I can't respond to what you're saying. So, you know. Well, you know, I will tell you, there is a good flip side to what's going on. Believe it or not, the Palestinians enjoy a lot of support in America. If you go to the campuses, if you go to Berkeley, if you go to UCLA, if you go to Harvard, Columbia, and so on, you will find that there is a great deal of understanding and a great deal of support for the Palestinians. And it is beginning to make an inroad, because when you see what's going on, I mean, the American public, Robert Fisk, who is a great journalist, you know, a great British journalist, made a trip across America. And he went to the little towns, you know, little towns in Iowa, Kansas, many other places. And he talked to small audiences. And he found a great deal of sympathy, a great deal of understanding to the Palestinian cause, and indeed a great deal of support. So we're beginning to just itch our way in into the American consciousness.
Instead of calling them settlers, you should really be calling them squatters.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
It's a very positive ring in North America when the country was settled by a settler. And we should not be calling those people who are in the Palestinian territories settlers.
Well, it's a good term. I agree with you. I think they are marauding squatters.
The Balfour Declaration and the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the emigration of Jews from Europe during the 30s all came before the Holocaust.
Right. Right, of course, because, you know, as I said, this whole thing was born in the womb of a grand colonial project. I mean, you know, Britain and France were dying colonial powers, and they wanted to hang on to what they had. They knew that the Middle East is strategic. They knew that the Middle East was weak. It was governed by the old ill man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire, and it was there to grab. And I believe that Britain did a very, cynical thing by declaring the Balfour Declaration to meet its political ends and means, and they have exploited that issue. And you know what? World War II came to service that goal.
There are some 7 to 9 million Arab Americans. There are many who are quite wealthy. Mm-hmm. My question for you is this. Jews have been very focused, have dedicated their wealth to buying the media and putting their point of view, and we must hand them credit for what they've done. Why have Arab Americans not devoted some of their wealth to buying the media and putting out what you are saying?
Well, that's a very good question. And believe me, it's a question that is being addressed to Arab Americans time and time and time again. I mean, you know, whether it's in conferences that are held every now and then or in gatherings or something. The fact of the matter that Arab Americans are really, by and large, are either recent immigrants or immigrants that have come into this country and were completely assimilated into the society that came from Lebanon and Syria and so on, and were really... they did not discover their identity until very, very late. The media issue in America is, the Israeli-American connection is a little more than a media event. You know, I think that Arab Americans need to become more active. And I will tell you, I give it to the ADL. The ADL are everywhere. There's probably someone among us today. I don't know. But they are everywhere. So they are everywhere. They are on campuses. They tackle the issues. But I can also assure you that there's a new generation of Arab Americans and Palestinian Americans who are very, very active on campuses. They're young. They're dynamic. They're part of the society. They can draw the correlation between, you know, the great aspirations and the great foundation of this country and what they aspire for countries in the Middle East. You know, what we ought to stick to, and I think that would really gives us a guiding light. What we ought to stick to, that America is founded on principles of freedom and democracy and all men are created equal. I think this is what we ought to advocate. We should not allow a government such as the one in Saudi Arabia to continue on. We should ask for real reforms. They are asking Arafat for reform. And Arafat definitely needs to be reformed. You know, he may be beyond reform. I don't know. But he definitely needs to be reformed. But also, we must reform what we call our allies. I think there's a double standard here. We must reform what is going on in Egypt. We must reform what's going on in Saudi Arabia. And we definitely must put our foot down and stop Israel from its aggression. It is not good. It is not good for the prestige of America that on April 4th at the lawn of the White House, President Bush came out and he says this aggression must stop. He was talking about the incursions and so on. They must be rolled back. And then a week later he comes out and he says, okay, we'll give you 2 more weeks. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we ought to be outraged about.